Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Obama is not moving from the spotlight today. Speaking at the White House before cheering nurses, he said, "Too many people are being cut off from health coverage, and that's un-American." A CNN poll shows his speech last night before Congress had a positive effect. Before the speech, a little more than half of respondents supported his proposals. Afterwards, two-thirds did. And Republican Congressman Joe Wilson of South Carolina has apologized for his moment last night.
There are also those who claim that our reform efforts would ensure illegal immigrants. This, too, is false. The reforms I'm proposing would not apply to those who are here illegally.
Wilson there accusing the president of lying, even though others, including John McCain on the Today Show this morning, said he wasn't. Well, perhaps the disinformation can be traced to Sean Hannity of Fox News, who made this charge on August 27th.
And finally, in Hannity's America, the president has repeatedly accused his opponents of peddling falsehoods in the health care debate. Now, one of them, he says, is that illegal immigrants will be covered by the bill. Now, the Washington Examiner notes that according to the Congressional Research Service, the critics are right. The bill, quote, does not contain any restrictions on non-citizens, whether legally or illegally present.
Actually, the New York Times reports that the nonpartisan Congressional Research Service says exactly the opposite. Well, let's start today with some fact-checking. Experts estimate that there are about 6.8 million uninsured illegal immigrants in the U.S. That was in 2007. And that's out of a total of almost 12 million illegal immigrants total. Right now, most hospitals have laws on the books that say they and others, the illegal immigrants, must be treated when they arrive at emergency rooms. But what is the truth about how they'd be insured under a new health care reform proposal? Joining us first, the Pulitzer Prize-winning PolitiFact.com reporter Angie Holin. Angie, is the president right?
We found that the president is right. Basically, the bill does not address illegal immigration in any substantive way. All the laws that affect illegal immigrants in health care right now, particularly how they're excluded from Medicaid, those stay in place. The laws that require hospitals to treat people who show up and are gravely ill, those stay in place. There's a clause that specifically says illegal immigrants may not receive affordability credits to help them buy insurance on an exchange. Now, the Congressional Research Service found that when they set up this national health insurance exchange where people can go and comparison shop, that there is no mechanism to specifically bar illegal immigrants from buying insurance if they can pay for it. But the illegal immigrants would have to pay full price for their insurance just like they do now.
So there's no government subsidy?
There's no government subsidy. And when you look at what the legislation does, it pretty much leaves in place the status quo for illegal immigrants.
So a president got a correct from you on your truth-o-meter there.
That's right. And we actually rated Joe Wilson's statement that you lie, and we said that was false. Obama did not lie.
Well, let's move on to some other issues. The president also said if you already have health insurance through your job, Medicare, Medicaid, or the VA, nothing in the proposed plan will require you or your employer to change the coverage or the doctor you have. Now, there seemed to be a new word here, require. So first of all, how did you rate that statement as it stands?
We rated that statement true.
But he used to say you won't lose your insurance, period. Now he says you won't be required to lose your insurance. Tell us more about that.
Well, there are a lot of new regulations in this bill that are going to affect the healthcare industry. They're going to be insurers are going to be required to cover preventive care. They won't be allowed to exclude from pre-existing conditions. So we're talking about some significant changes to the healthcare industry as we know it. Now, previously, Obama would make blanket statements like, you can keep the coverage you have, you can keep the doctor you have. And we found that was pushing the envelope. We rated that statement half true because there were no guarantees that employers would not choose to change coverage the way they can now. His new statement is, he says, there's nothing in the plan that will force you to change. And that is true. Yeah. So we rated it true.
But your employer might decide to change, and you'll have no control over that.
Just like right now, right. Yes. It's still the case under reform.
Tort reform. The one full standing ovation from Republicans was when the president said to them that he understands the financial burden lawsuits place on doctors willing to consider tort reform. Your thoughts on that response?
This is very interesting. What Obama said was he's going to direct the Secretary of Health and Human Services to allow pilot projects in different states, experiments to see what they can do to prevent lawsuits that might be frivolous or unwarranted. But thus far, there have been no major Republican initiatives included in health care reform. And that would be things like putting caps on jury awards. Obama has said he does not agree with those ideas, and they're not in the plan.
Okay, there are so many items, and we're just going to tick through a few today and then continue to look at them over the weeks to come. But the president also said that he wouldn't sign any bill that was not deficit neutral, that is, that adds a single penny to the deficit without, having a cut to offset it somewhere else. What'd you give that?
Well, this one we're going to have to monitor and see. The current plans in Congress right now are not deficit neutral. Leaders have said they hope to get it to be deficit neutral as they deal with the legislation. They have some accounting maneuvers that they want to use. Obama put out a new number last night. He said $900 billion total cost and deficit neutral. We're going to have to wait until we see the legislative language and the Congressional Budget Office scores that plan. So too soon to tell right now.
We'll wait with you. Angie Hollin, reporter for PolitiFact.com in Washington, D.C. Angie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, and as we said, last night the president confronted opponents of health care reform that he said are spreading misinformation.
Some of people's concerns have grown out of bogus claims spread by those whose only agenda is to kill reform at any cost. The best example is the claim made not just by radio and cable talk show hosts, but by prominent politicians, that we plan to set up panels of bureaucrats with the power to kill off senior citizens. Now, such a charge would be laughable if it weren't so cynical and irresponsible. It is a lie, plain and simple.
In reality, the provision under discussion would require Medicare to reimburse doctors for their time when they advise patients on end-of-life decisions. And the people who pioneered that concept have watched as conservative talk show hosts and politicians, including Sarah Palin and Newt Gingrich, equated that to government-run death panels that would pull the plug on grandma. The Washington Post recently tracked down the origins of the provision to the Gunderson Lutheran Hospital in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Now, that hospital pioneered the end-of-life counseling program that urges families to plan while they have their health. And today, 90% of the town's 52,000 residents have end-of-life directives. That's twice the national average. And the hospital testified in Congress to get the doctor reimbursed provision included in health care legislation. Bud Hamas is director of medical humanities at Gunderson Lutheran. He's a clinical ethicist with a PhD in philosophy. Bud, welcome.
Thank you.
And first of all, your thoughts on the president's speech last night, specifically when he dealt with the rumor about death panels.
It was kind of gratifying and maybe kind of feeling like this is something that needed to be said. This legislation about reimbursement for physicians counseling or helping their patients make decisions about future medical decisions was actually in process well before the health care reform. It is clearly something I think that would improve the care of patients in our country. And there never was anything more than a payment for a service. And so from my perspective, this provided more benefits for people in our country than they currently have and was a very positive thing for patient care.
Well, and it's from the readings that we've been doing, it seems like people in your town feel it's been very positive for them. Tell us how this all started, because you were instrumental. We understand you're a native of La Crosse, returned to the city after your studies to be director of medical humanities. What did you see? What was it that caught your attention?
I started to do what people now call ethics consults. I would be asked to come in to talk with families or patients when a conflict arose or maybe uncertainty existed about what we should do regarding the treatment of a particular patient. And what I saw was an emerging pattern of patients who were now incapacitated, were significantly ill or injured and no likelihood of recovery, and family members who had to make decisions on behalf of their loved one, and they had no idea what the patient did or did not want.
Give us an example of one of those real-life situations.
The pattern I actually saw involved dialysis patients. These are patients who have kidney failure and are on a life-saving treatment called dialysis. But there are often complications, and the complications that I was seeing are severe stroke, where patients were now left rendered unconscious. They were not going to recover. They were not going to wake up. But we could keep them alive if we continued dialysis. The ethical question then is, should we continue dialysis? My question would be, if your mother could speak for herself right now and understand everything that you understand, what would she tell us?
Meaning understand that she was not going to ever wake up from the situation.
Right. So there was a hypothetical question,
sure,
because the patient couldn't tell us this and wasn't ever going to be able to tell us. And I repeatedly got the same answer from all these different families over the course of a few years, which is, we don't know. And they would also say, if we only knew.
It's one of the hardest conversations that any family member can have, because you don't want to acknowledge that there is even such a thing as end of life. But your hospital began urging families to plan while everybody was healthy, to have these conversations, to write directives, to tell hospitals what they should do. And you assigned physicians to talk to them about, you know, what medicine can and can't do, to explain to family members what it would mean if they had to serve as a healthcare agent and express somebody's wishes if they couldn't express them. What did you see start happening in your hospital when you started doing this program?
We started to develop a training program for what we call advanced care planning facilitators, nurses, social workers, and sometimes and even chaplains, who get very intense training so that they have the skills to assist and work with the physician as a kind of team player to help these conversations. And that helps us deal with the resource issue, both regarding the physician's time and the payment issue. So we use less expensive health professionals, if you want to put it that way, to assist it with a physician in making sure that these conversations happen.
And we understand that over time, people started doing it more and more. People started talking to their neighbors about it. Practice caught on of making sure you had an end-of-life directive, to the point that your patients at Gunderson, we understand, now spend an average of 13 and a half days in the hospital in their final 2 years of life. This is in contrast with big city hospitals. The Washington Post cites the University of California at L.A., 31 days. University of Miami Hospital, 39 days. So in essence, what's happening is that people are choosing not to spend a lot of time in the hospital with a lot of services at the end of their lives.
Correct. When patients really understand what their prognosis is and really understand how much or how little medical treatment might benefit them, when that benefit becomes small and the burden of treatment becomes high, people say, gee, if I have a limited amount of time to live and what you can do is extend my life by just a small bit of time and I'm going to have to go through all of that stuff, I would rather spend time with my family.
That's Bud Hammes with Gunderson Lutheran Hospital in La Crosse, Wisconsin. They pioneered the doctor end-of-life counseling program that lawmakers would like. They'd like to require Medicare to reimburse doctors or hospitals for such a counseling program. When we come back, we'll ask them to answer the fear that doctors may counsel patients to die sooner. Also later today, 9/11 culture, from Bruce Springsteen's The Rising to Dennis Leary's Rescue Me. Back after a break. Here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Bud Hammes, a clinical ethicist at Gunderson Lutheran Hospital in La Crosse, Wisconsin. His hospital testified before Congress to encourage lawmakers to allow Medicare to pay doctors or hospitals for time spent counseling people on end-of-life decisions. Bud's hospital is a pioneer in helping people draft end-of-life directives. But, Bud, you know, these are not, in your plan, government bureaucrats, but respond to the fear that they might still encourage people to limit care at the end of life.
This is part of the training about how to separate one's own values. We actually talk about it in our training. What if a patient says to you, what would you do if you were me? And the typical response should be, I'm not you. And what I'm interested in is knowing what you would want in this circumstance. So the real goal here is to explore and understand what's important to the patient in light of their medical condition and the reasonable prospect that treatment will or will not help them. There are people who say, I want that. I don't care if there's only a 1% chance. That's what I want you to do. That's what their advance directive says.
What do you say to people who live in the big cities who say a couple of things? First of all, your doctors at your hospital are salaried. Doctors who are fee-based, which is most of the doctors across the country, that's going to cost a lot for Medicare to pay them for that hour, whereas your doctors are salaried. Also, you use a team approach where your doctors work closely together, and that also minimizes waste. And many big city areas can't do that. You go from hospital to hospital and see different specialists. So your team approach also makes this an easier thing for you to do. And also, you know, as the Washington Post put it, you're in a Midwestern town where people may be calling on a pragmatic German heritage, as it's been said, and may be more willing to do this.
Yeah. Well, the first thing I'd say about that is the purpose of this is not to save money or to reduce utilization. And I don't know if this program were expanded to large metropolitan areas, if it will reduce utilization of services. I think it may, and how much it might or might not is really not a concern to me. What I do know is patients everywhere in the United States, their wishes are not known, and we are making treatment decisions for people who we don't know if we're making the right decision. I think that's a moral issue. I don't think, as a health professional, a doctor should be doing something to a patient whose life expectancy is short, where the treatment may not be a good thing in the patient's eyes, unless we know that is, in fact, what the patient wanted. In my view, there is really no excuse anywhere in the country for us not having that information. I mean, if a doctor failed to ask a patient, are you allergic to any medication, and we didn't know that, and we didn't record that, and we didn't follow that information, that would be negligence. I think it's actually negligence that we don't know what patients' wishes are, particularly in the last stages of life. And we should take our care and tailor it to the individual and not to some routine of care, because that's just the way we do things, or because it generates more revenue, or whatever the reason might be. The fact is that in most places, we don't ask patients what they really want. We don't inform them of what their choices are, and we don't help them make decisions that reflect their interests, their values, and their goals.
But your thoughts, we understand, again, Washington Post has reported extensively on this, that officials at Gundersen Hospital were upset when Senator Charles Grassley, who was thought to be an ally in backing this provision, was one who used the language that this provision would mean pulling the plug on grandma, and he said that the provision should be dropped. But I'm wondering your thoughts on another politician who turned on the provision, and that's Georgia's Newt Gingrich, whose father-in-law received treatment at Gundersen and who had previously praised the end-of-life care he got there.
I believe it's Mr. Gingrich's opinion that what has happened here at Gundersen is good care, and I think he experienced that personally.
But he's one of those saying that this provision
right.
would mean a slippery slope to government bureaucrats telling you what to do at the end of life, and there, I don't believe there was a government bureaucrat at Gundersen.
Correct. So Mr. Gingrich seems to be opposed to the payment of physicians for this particular service. I just disagree with him. I don't see that the government payment for that service would lead to any type of government intervention any more than when Medicare pays for open heart surgery or dialysis or any other treatment that we think that the government is imposing itself simply because it pays for a service.
Well, let's end where we began. President Obama pretty much gave a tongue-lashing to people who have misrepresented this provision that, again, was pioneered at your hospital. But he didn't say unequivocally that it would stay, and there are reports that it's going to go.
I understand that for lots of reasons, it may be politically untenable to include this part of legislation in the health care reform bill. And I think American people need to decide about what type of medical system that they want. And if they want a system that simply reimburses physicians for medical treatment, then that's what physicians will get paid to do, and they will have a propensity to focus their attention on the things they get paid to do. I would prefer a system that also, not in place of, but also pays physicians for taking time to actually talk with their patients, explore what the patient's values and goals are, so that we actually know on a regular routine basis when we face a major crisis and we have to make major decisions on the patient's behalf, we actually know what that patient does want us to do and does not want us to do.
Quick question. When you saw this thing that is so popular in your town, in your hospital, has meant better end of life according to the patients and also saved money, even though that's not your goal, when you first heard it referred to as a death panel, what was your response?
I guess my response was laughter. The distortion of the reality and was so far off the mark that it first made me laugh and then it made me sad, because we now have patients in our town who have a fear which is unfounded, but we now have to take time to address that fear before they're willing or interested in doing the planning, which has become well accepted as part of good care in our community.
Bud Hammes, Director of Medical Humanities at Gunderson Lutheran Hospital in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Bud, thank you so much for your time speaking to us today.
It was good talking to you.
Okay, quick look ahead. It's 9/11 tomorrow. We'll speak with an author who will recall his fatherless childhood in a town that would have many 9/11 orphans. That's tomorrow. Back after the latest news, here and now. President Obama's Mideast envoy, former Senator George Mitchell, arrives in that region this week for meetings with Israeli officials. Topping the agenda, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's decision this week to allow hundreds of new Israeli homes in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. It's the first government-approved settlement construction since Netanyahu came to power in March. It comes despite U.S. pressure to halt settlement building, and Palestinians say the new settlements will jeopardize future peace talks. Tim Franks is the BBC correspondent in Jerusalem. Tim, first, can you explain the timing of this new settlement plan? Why now?
There's plenty of speculation that in order for there to be a resumption of talks between the Palestinians and the Israelis, what the Israelis are going to have to come up with is some sort of temporary freeze in terms of at the least the granting of permission for buildings, new buildings on the West Bank to be constructed. There's talk of there being a suspension of maybe 6 months as far as the Israelis are concerned. Now, before that happens, if that were to happen, what the Israelis want to do is to grant some planning applications. The settlers who live in these places say that their population is growing apace and they desperately need these new houses. I should say that there's plenty of construction that goes on in any case in these places. So some of these numbers have a slightly symbolic value.
Also, Netanyahu is under a lot of pressure from both the settlers and this timeline to give out these permits. Just remind us briefly how many Israeli settlers are living in this area. What's the history of their being there?
Israel captured East Jerusalem and the West Bank after the Six-Day War of 1967, and it began to settle these places, which the rest of the world regards as occupied territory, and indeed international law holds that settlement of occupied territory is illegal. Israel doesn't recognize that. It has annexed East Jerusalem, and it has said that the territory in the West Bank is disputed, not occupied. That notwithstanding, Israel has come under a lot of criticism for its settlements, and it's thought that about 500,000 Jewish settlers now live in those two places.
Do they see themselves as a bulwark, as a placeholder, as a bulwark against Palestinians?
There's a great variety of views. There are a lot of people inside East Jerusalem, Jews inside East Jerusalem, who would not regard themselves as settlers at all. They're what are referred to as economic settlers. They have absolutely no problem about where they live as long as they can afford to live somewhere. But there are plenty of others who believe that this land, in fact, in a way that is much more fundamental than the land to the west, Tel Aviv and Haifa and other big Israeli cities that are regarded as fully Israeli by the rest of the world, that the places they're living in the West Bank have much more biblical resonance for the Jewish people.
Well, President Obama has demanded a freeze on all settlement construction. The Obama administration is pushing for a meeting between Prime Minister Netanyahu and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas at the UN later this month. What does the settlement issue do to all of that?
There's no doubt that the Americans are very, very keen to push ahead with negotiations if at all possible, but they have set a high bar. They have said themselves that they want to see a stop to settlement activity. That is pushing the Israelis hard. If the Israelis push back, It's going to be fascinating to see what the Americans do. But let's not forget, all this talk about settlements is simply to get the two sides in a room. It's not actually about solving the fundamental problems in the Middle East.
Tim, one last question. A column in the Los Angeles Times today says Fatah is planning for a Palestinian state in 2 years, regardless of talks. They're going ahead and planning for it. And they also say it'll be difficult for Hamas, sort of the breakaway Palestinian group, to reject that plan. Your reaction to that?
I think these things have to be dealt with a bit of caution, but at the same time, it's also worth bearing in mind that a lot of Palestinians believe that the chance for a negotiated Palestinian state is slipping away. And indeed, a lot of Israelis also believe that there isn't really anything much left of a negotiated peace process.
The BBC's Tim Frank speaking to us from Jerusalem. Tim, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
Well, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this or anything on the program. Take a second to say you can go to hereandnow.org and click on Contact Us to send an email or just scroll down and leave a comment right there. We'll be back in 30 seconds with the cultural landscape post 9/11, Here and Now. Welcome back.
Can't see nothing in front of me. Can't see nothing coming up behind. Make my way through this darkness. I can't feel nothing but this chain that binds me.
Bruce Springsteen singing The Rising from his 2002 album of the same name, issued less than a year after the attacks of 9/11 killed nearly 3,000. Bruce said he was inspired by reading in the New York Times Portraits of Grief profiles that so many of the victims of 9/11 had been his fans. So it's pretty obvious that his CD is part of a 9/11 culture. But what about this?
Chicken Little! What is it? What's going on?
The sky is falling! The sky is falling!
The sky is falling!
Are you crazy? No, it's true! Come with me!
No, the sun...
A scene from the 2005 animated film Chicken Little. According to our next guest, that film is the fullest expression of the post-9/11 father fantasy, a reassurance that fathers will be there for their sons, even when the sky is falling, even when they couldn't be there on 9/11. Jeffrey Melnick is Associate Professor of American Studies at Babson College. His new book on the subject is called simply 9/11 Culture. Jeff, welcome back.
Thank you.
And, of course, I have to ask, really, Chicken Little? We loved the animated film, but are you reading too deep to tie it to 9/11?
I don't think so. The thing about Chicken Little that I found so appealing was that it put its work right out front. The basic story, and this is a spoiler alert here, mm-hmm. so if you haven't seen it yet, I'm sorry, any of you out there, the basic story is that the sky is falling, unlike the original fable where it's just a hysterical chicken who's worried about the sky falling. Here the sky is falling, but the damage isn't permanent. Yeah. It's just a test for the main character, and the test is whether he can rise to the challenge of being masculine enough.
And whether his father will not just dismiss him as an hysterical chicken or actually believe him and come to help him.
Exactly.
And he does. And that's so reassuring because, I mean, one of the things you say in your book is that post 9/11 father figures like firemen and policemen couldn't. And this sense of the helplessness of men in the wake of 9/11 is far more obvious in something like Rescue Me with Dennis Leary.
Absolutely. That's a fascinating show that keeps wavering between this kind of hyper macho firefighter who talks trash constantly in the locker room about which women he's conquered, and on the other hand, showing us characters who are just completely undone by the trauma of 9/11, who just can't figure out how to move forward, can't figure out how to be good fathers, can't figure out how to be good husbands,
right.
And so on.
It's set in a New York City fire station after 9/11. Let's listen to a scene you've analyzed.
So I buy a dinner, a ton of drinks, it's getting late, so I make my move. Get this. She shuns me.
She shuns you.
Blows me off. Leaves in a huff. You believe this?
What I can't believe is you making a move on a chick with sideburns.
Hey, Tommy, it's getting slow out there, pal. All that pussy I was getting after 9/11, now nothing. People forget.
Yeah. Sad commentary.
Well, you know, with a lot of bleeps in there, you know, we did hear post 9/11 that the firemen were saying all those women that were running down to meet a rescuer are gone.
Right. I mean, the show doesn't exactly know what to make of that. It's not clear in that scene. And I like watching it with students because students are never clear on who's being made fun of in that scene. Clearly, the woman from the night before is being made fun of on a physical level, but it's also obvious that the firefighters are being made fun of. The notion that they deserved something in terms of the company of women after 9/11.
But, you know, how do we get away with that culturally now? And Dennis Leary does. It's a hugely popular show because it would have been a sacrilege to say anything, even mildly poking fun at a firefighter just after 9/11.
Right. It's got to be Dennis Leary. He's got a lot of money in the bank as far as firefighters are concerned, well before 9/11. And he also waited just long enough. One of the things I try to argue in the book is that there's space for something like Rescue Me, not in the year after 9/11, not in the 2 years after 9/11, but little by little there's some cracks in what you're calling the more or less sanctified culture of firefighters.
Yeah. Well, and that's a blatant program about post-9/11 culture. But you see resonances of 9/11 in the ABC television series Lost. This is the story of the plane crash survivors flashing back and forward in time. Where do you see it there?
Well, really in the basic premise, which is how do you live in the culture after the plane crash? I mean, that really is my whole concern with that show, is who's going to be in charge? Who do we listen to after the plane crashes? And the show wavers constantly between, do we listen to the older, more philosophical man? Do we listen to the more action-oriented young couple who, you know, feature so much in the first season in particular? The minute you put a plane crash up on screen, the minute you put a plane on screen, and that's why in the book one of the things I say is that obviously the movie United 93 is a 9/11 movie, but so is Snakes on a Plane, so is Red Eye, so is Flight Plan.
Snakes on a Plane, a 9/11 movie.
Well, I think any time in the few years after 9/11 that you put a major scene of anxiety, and Snakes on a Plane certainly fits the bill, we're talking about a culture. It's not the first time that we've been interested in, you know, airplane crisis movies. I can remember a time in the 1970s, and that was really the result of the hijacking fears of the time. That were much different. But certainly in the couple years after 9/11, there was this rush to make airplane anxiety movies.
Right. Well, and I'm thinking back to Lost for a second, this odd story of these people on an island. I'm wondering if there's also some wishful thinking there. You know, maybe the 9/11 victims are on some island somewhere in some parallel reality.
Right, and that's absolutely true. There's a kind of fantasy there, too, which is that nobody got hurt in the crash. It's kind of compensatory in a way. The plane crashed, a couple people died, but we don't care about them because they don't turn out to be characters on the show,
right?
So we get to see the terrible crash, and then we get to see these people starting all over again. So whether they're really on an island somewhere or not isn't as important, I think you're absolutely right, as the fantasy that life goes on in a brand new, exciting, complex way.
Right. Well, you quote others who say that when we look at 9/11 culture, it's something that is indelibly time-stamped 9/12. In other words, as you say, we don't look at airplanes the same way anymore. We just can't. It's indelible. We have a different feeling the day after 9/11. So Bob Dylan's CD, Love and Theft, which came out on 9/11, and many people think they hear things about 9/11 in it, can't be because it was written before 9/11?
Right, absolutely. But we don't hear it as written before 9/11 because we didn't hear it till that day or later that day or the next day or that week. So everything we hear about that record or Jay-Z's original Blueprint record, which also came out on September 11th, we now hear and see the whole cultural phenomenon of through these September 12th glasses. And there are a number of critics who have rushed in to say, you know, Dylan, he's a prophet. What did he know? He didn't know anything. And not any more than he ever knew, which is maybe everything. but that's Dylan. And so we put this new framework on it, which says, how do we read this now?
I got my back to the sun, cause the light is too intense.
Bob Dylan's Sugar Baby from that CD, Love and Theft, again released on 9/11, 8 years ago tomorrow. Amazing that 8 years have passed. We're looking at 9/11 culture with Jeff Melnick of Babson College. You might remember that Doonesbury cartoon, a White House press conference where the answer to every reporter's question about Iraq, the deficit, the environment, was 9/11. Well, is it the answer to all our cultural questions as well? Jeff says it is to many. We're going to have more with him after a break, here and now. You'll open up your eyes. On the eve of September 11th, we're speaking with Babson College American Studies professor Jeff Melnick about what he's calling 9/11 culture. He says it includes author Sherman Alexie's short story Flight Patterns, in which a Native American character examines his complaints about the U.S., Don DeLillo's novel Falling Man, which takes on that oh-so-taboo topic, sculptor Eric Feischl's 2002 piece Tumbling Woman, with a woman tumbling head over heels, also reminds us of those horrible images of 9/11. Feischl said it wasn't really about falling as much as floating, but post-9/11 it was still too much, and his piece at Rockefeller Plaza in New York was covered over after outrage complaints. But Jeff Melnick, you also talk about all the missing posters and all those snapshots that were put up immediately after 9/11. Very moving. But you say also people understanding in what you call the Internet 2.0 culture, it's now their job to document life.
So one of the fascinating things about this 9/11 culture is that it was everywhere. It didn't have a center. So the snapshot culture, I really felt, was this unbelievable outpouring of folks saying, I want to have something to say here. I want to be in the game.
Well, then, of course, there were the rumors. We're going to put aside the conspiracy rumors, but I want to ask you about the corporate-sponsored rumors, clearly cultural, and the biggest had to be Clear Channel Communications. Now, this is the country's biggest radio station group owner, and the rumor was that they had a list of banned songs. They denied that they had the list of banned songs, but they did.
Apparently, the list was created by a middle manager at a local radio station somewhere, and it circulated widely. And so Clear Channel quickly got in the business of denying the rumor because it allowed them to have a position as a good guy pretty quickly. It allowed them to say, we're not banning anything. In one of their press releases, they said, we believe that radio is a local medium, which is a funny thing for a huge
corporate
giant to say, and we're going to let all our stations do what they want. By that time, the list was everywhere.
But it worked for them because rumor-squashing websites believed them, so Clear Channel got to have the rumor and also got to enact the list. And on the list was the strangest assortment. Yes, there was Shelley Fabre's Johnny Angel.
Johnny Angel, how I love him. He's got something that I can't resist.
But there was also John Lennon's Imagine and any song by the group Rage Against the Machine. This is 1992's Killing in the Name.
Some of those that work forces draw the same that burn crosses. Killing in the name of.
It's a real having your cake and eating it too situation.
Well, and one can understand maybe protecting listeners, maybe survivors' families from songs that might remind them of 9/11. There's that. But they got to also ban songs on political
bases. They tried to. But, of course, a few days after the list circulated, there was Neil Young on the big telethon singing his version of John Lennon's Imagine.
You also point out that 9/11 didn't produce the same cultural experience for all Americans, particularly some African-Americans and Native Americans. We have one song from Willie King. It's his song Terrorized from his 2002 album. Tell us a little bit about your theory and how we're hearing it here.
Willie King's a really interesting example because he's someone who's not only a blues singer, but he's trained at the Highlander Folk School as a social activist and organizer. So he jumps in this moment to pick up on this key word, terrorism. He very quickly tries to redefine the word and ask his listeners to think about what the word terrorism or terrorized means for African Americans.
I say you talk about terror. People have been terrorized all my days. No, you took my name, and you know you left me, me and Jane.
The rap artist KRS-One said more pointedly, 9/11 didn't happen to African Americans. It happened to them down the block, the rich and powerful. Now, others came forward, like Muhammad Ali on the telethon, to say, no, we are all in this together. But then there were also the African American artists who reached out to groups they saw as replacing them as the new suspect group. There was that famous Boondocks cartoon strip that announced that, hey, blacks aren't the most hated group in America anymore. So let's listen to Beware. This is a 2003 collaboration between rap artist Jay-Z and the British Indian artist known as Punjabi MC.
Yeah. yes. Mom, I ain't gotta tell you, but it's your boy Ho from the U.S. You just lay down slow. Catch your boy mingling, ingling, meddling in the Netherlands. Checking in daily under aliases. We rebellious, we back home. Screaming, leave Iraq alone. But all my soldiers in the field, I will wish you safe return. But only love kills war when will they learn.
Jeffrey Melnick, did you really see this? African Americans actually reaching out to peoples that now were trusted less by some Americans.
Yeah, there's this fascinating wave that stretches, say, roughly from 2003 to 2005 of rap artists jumping into this. And I took it as a real sign that African Americans weren't going to accept this rhetoric of being the, quote, good minority group now. And these artists like Jay-Z, like Eric Sermon, like the producer Timbaland, again and again reach out to the sounds of South Asia and of the Middle East to say, you know what, we're connected to these people.
Well, one of the most disturbing images from 9/11 was largely held back from Americans, but eventually made its way into the culture. And I'm talking, of course, about the falling man. The horrible images of people falling or jumping from the trade towers. It's the culture deciding we're not going to see that.
Absolutely.
Except now, the opening credits of Mad Men, the wildly popular show about 1950s advertising men, shows a sort of a cartoon of a businessman tumbling from a building, and no one bats an eyelash.
It's amazing how far we've come in 5 years or so. I'm glad you mentioned the Mad Men image, because folks have been talking about that opening sequence, how wonderful the graphics are, and how it captures something about a couple Hitchcock movies. And no one, as far as I can tell, is talking about how it says something about people jumping from buildings. For a couple years after 9/11, you couldn't show an image of somebody jumping from building. That was, I don't want to say censored, but it was more or less taboo.
Oh, who would want to? It was a horror. One of the most heartbreaking treatments of that image, we feel, is author Jonathan Safran Foer's character Oscar. In Jonathan's 2005 book, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, Oscar is a 9-year-old whose father died in the towers. He wants to know how, and he's searching all over New York City to find out how his father might have died. And in this reading from Jonathan Safran Foer, Oscar's just met a person who tells him about a woman, a waitress, who died in the towers as well.
"That's so weird to think about," I said. "What is?" "Well, that she worked there. Maybe she knew my dad, or not knew him, but maybe she served him that morning. He was there in the restaurant. He had a meeting. Maybe she refilled his coffee or something. It's possible. Maybe they died together. Maybe they'd gone up to the roof together. You saw in some of the pictures that people jumped together and held hands. So maybe they did that. Or maybe they just talked to each other until the building fell. What would they have talked about? They were obviously so different. Maybe he told her about me. I wonder what he told her. I couldn't tell how it made me feel to think about him holding somebody's hand."
Just heartbreaking.
Yeah.
In the end of the book, Oscar Schell creates his own image of the falling man. What's that?
It's amazing. There's a flip book at the very end, which is, you know, one of the most sort of rudimentary forms of children's culture. You know, you take a bunch of pictures together and you show them real fast and they give you like an animation. And what Oscar creates is an image of the falling man in reverse. He creates an image of the falling man ascending. Child's eye view of a way out of the terrible conundrum of imagining jumpers after 9/11, to imagine that there's a moment of flight, to imagine that there's a moment of transcendence at the very end.
That's Jeffrey Melnick, Associate Professor of American Studies at Babson College. His new book is called simply 9/11 Culture. Jeffrey, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
I see Mary in the garden. In the garden of a thousand sighs, there's holding pictures of our children dancing in a sky filled with light. May you feel your arms around me. May you feel your blood mixed with mine. The dream of life comes to me like a catfish dancing on the end of my line. Sky and blackness and sorrow.